Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 312, my talk with improviser Chris Griswold. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You get a free audiobook download as well as access to hundreds of books and podcasts, including this one, you guys. You can listen to Yes But Why podcast on Audible. And between the amazing romance novels you're reading, or maybe horror novels, maybe some true crime, who knows what you're reading? There's also like cool music shows on there and some other podcasts that aren't Yes But Why, but you're not listening to those. You're listening to Yes But Why. So you can find it on Audible. And so that's why you need to get your account. Go now to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy to sign up and get your account today. Start listening. Start reading. Or maybe listen to Yes But Why there. Who knows? Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is the consulting company that my husband Chris and I run to help podcasters. We are essentially just here as a resource for podcasters who need us. Give us a call, send a message on the website, whatever you need, let us know. Sometimes we're the people that help you. Sometimes we send you to one of our friends and say they can help you. And it's really just about, you know, being there for people when they're trying to put together a podcast. It's not always easy to do. And, you know, if you don't know all the different steps or, you know, you haven't stepped in it a few times like we have, you know, you're not sure how to make the right decisions. So we're here for you. If you want some help, if there's any questions you have, we're open to answering them. Just check out podcastcadet.com. The website has some videos and stuff on it, you know, that might help you without you even having to contact us, but maybe you do, and we're here for you, whatever it is that you need. And if you happen to get something that costs money, well, mention code YBY20, and you'll get 20% off. Let us help. PodcastCadet.com. This week on Yes But Why, I was enchanted by Chris Griswold, founder of Thunderbolt Comedy and co-creator of the Pineapple app. Listen in as we talk about coaching improv, building a small business, and developing an app. I now present to you Yes But Why, episode 312, Chris Griswold on justice and being kind to each other. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is
Yes But Why.
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 This is the Yes But Why podcast.
By the way, what is it about improv that makes us all stay young looking for so long?
I think we're just lucky. Yeah, also, I think there is something real about being in touch with the childlike, playful spirit. Ooh, this will get us right in. I was like, I promise, this is exactly what I love talking about up top. So let's do it. I think like improv is kind of what can keep us young, and not even necessarily even the performing of improv, but the philosophy of improv in the way that, you know, if you are constantly looking for positive ways to connect, and if you're trying to, you know, be in the moment, I think that helps, you know, and, you know, and you're right. There's a lot of young looking, older improvisers, but I think there's something about the joy, like that the joy of it, that we, the playful spirit that we have from childhood is still burning in us. And we get to, you know, that's the fountain of youth. You know what I mean? Yeah. So the first thing I love asking people is about when they were a child. So we're all, now that we're adults and we do improv, we are connected to our childlike selves in the way that we are able to play and be free in this. But in real life, what was the ways that baby Chris was playing?
The ways that I was playing.
I mean, like with your siblings or your friends, like what were you doing? I can tell you what I was doing if it makes you need some ideas.
Oh, no, I got it. So like the thing is, like, I lived in a neighborhood where there weren't a lot of kids, and the kids that were there were like rough and tumble in a way that I wasn't, you know?
Yeah.
So I played by myself a lot. I would have these very elaborate storylines for my G.I. Joes with alternate realities where the characters were bouncing back and forth between them with like teleportation or like gaps in reality, time travel. Like, this is the stuff I was playing. Everything I was doing was in like four dimensions with my G.I. Joes. It was really crazy, but it was just, that's what I did. And then I would, at night, a lot of the stuff I remember from my childhood also was just like sneaking television late at night, you know?
Was it a lot of sci-fi television based on the storylines you're telling me?
It was 1960s comedy. It was Laugh-In and Smothers Brothers, which honestly are probably two of my biggest inspirations in my comedy, I think. Tommy Smothers, actually, but you know, the Smothers Brothers in particular. You know, there's things like, you know, the Smothers Brothers got in so much trouble because like they were political, but in such a palatable way that it was really troubling, to some people. And then Laugh-In, oh God, when I was a kid, there was, who was it? It was Tony Curtis. Tony Curtis was guest starring, it was a guest hosting an episode of Laugh-In. And, at every commercial break, one of the women in the cast would give him a kiss. And that was like a funny running joke. And then there was a black, actress who was in the cast, and they said that the censors would not allow them to kiss. So he gave her his room key. And as a child, I was just, my mind was blown that they were getting around the censors by doing something worse, in a way, worse, you know, whatever, more drastic than what the censors didn't want them to do.
Yeah.
And I loved that. So like when years later I learned that, when South Park Bigger, Longer, Non-Cut was going to get an NC-17 rating unless they changed some things in the movie. And then the guys from South Park, made the changes, but made them far worse. They added much more graphic jokes and sent it back, and then still got the R rating that they were trying for. Like that sort of thing, I've always like really appreciated.
Absolutely. That sort of, how did you find out about that Laugh-In moment or Smothers Brothers?
I watched it. That's the thing. So that was all of that was running. You know, Smothers Brothers and Laugh-In were both running on Nick at Night when I was little. I had a black and white television with, you know, two knobs on it. But I had, you know, one of those clickers that plugs into the outlet. Like you can turn a Christmas tree on and off. I had that, so that I could turn the TV off. My parents came upstairs. So they never knew how much I was just watching television late at night.
Yeah, I don't know how I got away with a lot of the television watching I did as well. Like, I was like, where were my parents? Because I remember hours sitting in front of this television. And mine was in the basement. How did I get there? Right. I don't remember.
Right. Facts of Life. I loved Facts of Life. Oh,
I
wanted
that.
To go to that girl's school so badly. And then, and I was obsessed with the movie Annie. Oh, love Annie. I used to have just dreams of like going on adventures with Annie when I was like four or five. I was obsessed with that movie. Honestly, I still love that movie. And I just watched it. Rhiannon and I watched it recently. So that was
the great one from our childhood or the new one? There's been a couple.
I mean, I would say the Quavonjane one was fun, and it was like great. I would say Cameron Diaz was not a very good Miss Hannigan. But, you know, the original one is just so good. And, like, looking back at it, I think the reason people thought of it as a bomb is that so much money was spent on it. And then, you know, but it's good. I really love that movie.
Yeah. You know, I was recently listening to a podcast with Judd Apatow, and he was saying that, you know, sometimes people, you know, judge movies too quickly, and that somebody along the way in his career had told him that, you know, wait 10 years and see if people are still talking about your movie. And if they are, then it's a success whether or not it made the money, because it's about the longevity of the idea of the art. Like, are people still watching it? And because they were talking about how apparently this year is Cable Guy's 25th anniversary. They were like, at the time when we made it, everyone was like, that was terrible. Why do we make this crap? And now it's like exciting, and like people are into it, and everybody's seen it, and it's like such a like cult classic. So it's funny how that is that sometimes you just never know what people actually like. You know, they don't make money, but that's all right.
Right. go ahead. Sorry.
No. I was just going to say, you've mentioned a few awesome, pieces of art that you are taking in to inspire you to go into comedy, and things that you were excited by. Did you always want to be a performer this whole time, as, you know, part of the, a lot of the stuff that you were into was very like big characters and like wild stuff.
Yes. I mean, I didn't, you know, as a kid, you're like, I could do all these things. I used to draw a lot too. My dad had a tendency to be like, oh, we got to make this into a career, whatever it is you like. You could make money off this now. And it's like, I just want to draw. Let me just like develop this thing. My dad put a lot of pressure on me on that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But it was funny because my parents would like support all of that stuff when I was a kid. But then when I got to college, they like were down on me doing anything. Like the most creative, I was able to study journalism, and they like put up with that basically. But it was weird because all through childhood, they were like encouraging my creativity. But then, and even acknowledging it as a way for me to make a living. But then when it came time for college, like, they did not want to hear about the improv show. Oh. They didn't want to hear about any of that stuff. It was a mind fuck, really. So,
wow. How interesting. I wonder what happened to them that their perspective changed. Like, I wonder if maybe they like, you know, had their own financial straits in a way that was like, you know, what, this is not something that he can handle. So we need to make sure he doesn't have to handle that. He needs to work in very lucrative journalism.
It's yeah, right. Well, and lucrative. You know, it's funny. I mean, both my parents grew up poor. My mom's parents ended up making some money at some point, but she grew up with a dad who was a coal miner. And, you know, my dad grew up poor also. And then my mom became a teacher, and my dad ran an economic incubator. So I come from two people that want to raise other people up and build things, really. And so I've internalized that. But to them, I think those were things that they understood how to do. And I've also come to realize the difficulty of coming from a very small rural town to try to work in entertainment and how difficult that is. Like, I just didn't. And the thing is, there's other people from the town that did okay. But I think, you know, it's funny. So much is provided to you in terms of like your survival skills and your, you know, your talents by your parents. And I never thought about how differently I was raised. My parents were in their late 30s when they had me. And in my town, that was like 15 years older than every other kid's parents. Other kids thought my parents were my grandparents. Other kids thought my parents were my grandparents. That also may lend to my kind of, I tend to have a dated vocabulary. The phrase rough and tumble, perhaps.
I use that all the time. We are the same age, so don't worry. Okay, it's our time.
Yeah. right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I appreciate the, again, acknowledging that we're the same age, I appreciate the examination of your life in this way. I am the same, which is also why I'm like in the podcast being like, let's reflect upon our lives. Right. But like, I get what you're saying about the way that they understood and about the moving from the rural place into the big city. I never thought about the culture shock of that, but there really is a lot of it. What was the first big city that you moved to that you had your first dose of culture shock?
I see. It's funny because I moved to Pittsburgh. I went to the University of Pittsburgh, but that didn't feel like a culture shock to me. And then moving to New York City didn't feel like a culture shock to me. I did that in 2004. From Pittsburgh. And I took to that very quickly. And in fact, New York is the place that I feel most at home, and I feel most fits what I want from a city, really. It was then when I moved back to Pittsburgh that I had a huge culture shock. That's when I felt like I had acclimated so much to New York City in that year that I had spent there, that moving back to Pittsburgh and having to take buses instead of the New York City subway system, which is one of the loves of my life. It was really, really tough. It's hard to navigate a bus system pre-Google Maps.
Yeah.
Whereas I could just get on the New York City subway, and the city had been built around the subway, so you can get anywhere you need to go for $2.75 or whatever it is now. And so I really missed that. But I would say, I dated someone for a long time who had been my manager at UCB, actually. And she would talk about when she went to NYU, and it was she was from Brooklyn. She was from East New York. And when she went to NYU and was in, Tisch School of the Arts, then that's when she encountered rich people for the first time. And that's the culture shock. And I didn't understand how much that was going on at UCB, like how much of UCB was really built on people with money favoring each other. It really was a place that was like, there's this idea of a system that benefits talent. A meritocracy.
Meritocracy? Yeah, there we go.
There's this idea that things are meritocracies, and that's just not a real thing in this case, right? And so it's so much of art and the business of art and entertainment is not about the quality of the output. It's really just about who you know and what power you have to offer somebody else. I mean, I started to realize how much emphasis was being put on people's resumes when people were auditioning for Herald teams at UCB. Mm-hmm. Like if somebody had connections, they were much likelier to get on a team than somebody that didn't.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And then there was such a tokenism for people that were like, especially as time went on, for them to go, oh no, we have people. And it was like, when I was working at UCB, I pitched a mentor program because I knew there were so many people that were just lost and didn't know how to get to the next step. We were a school that was mythologized to get people to the next step of their career. But then we weren't actually providing for that or addressing the myths as being myths, really. And I wanted to create a mentor program where it was going to be, it was at least going to start with, let's just get a couple performers to go to UCB East. Someone from the Herald team, someone from the sketch team, someone from maybe the digital teams, whatever, and just to hang out and students could just come and hang out and ask them questions. And maybe that's like a rotor, people, go through that and maybe they get free drinks for the night, whatever. They said, no, we've got a plan for a mentorship program. We're just going to identify people that we think are good and raise them up. And so the idea was, right? So we're going to control that. We're going to go top down instead of giving people tools so they can raise themselves up. And that's the sort of thinking that went on there a lot. And I always found that very frustrating, just never related to that.
Do you think that that has to do with the rich versus poor scenario?
Completely.
And is it because now, and I've definitely heard this with reference to the idea that like, you know, you, in improv schools, you know, a lot of times you're paying to play. You're paying to be in the classes, and then the classes get you stage time, right? So then if you don't have the money, you can't have the stage time. So that is definitely a barrier to entry for sure. But when I think of New York and wealthiness, I think of a much larger, like, crazy high level. Is that crowd what was, you know, the main crowd that you were butting your heads up with? Or
there were a lot of kids with trust funds that were hiding their wealth. Everybody would be just like, you go to McManus and like a table full of people was just sharing a pitcher of beer, because, you know, people didn't have money. And then you'd find out that somebody that you were taking class with or on your team, like, you go to their house, to their apartment, to go like work on something, and it would turn out, oh, they've got actually a penthouse that's paid for by their parents. And that happened a lot. Or people would move to LA and you'd see what they were selling, and it was like antique furniture and just like high-end electronics and stuff that nobody could afford. And the thing is, you know, I dated someone for a while who came from wealth, and she told me she hid it. She's from a completely different, she wasn't involved in comedy at all, but she hid her parents' wealth because she felt that it undermined her achievements. Sure. But the thing is, it doesn't. You got there because of that on some part, in some ways. You would not be where you are except for where you started. Sure. You know? Sure. And so that shouldn't be factored in on some level. It's very frustrating to be in New York and to be amongst all these people. And you're like, how come some of these people are getting all of this work done? How can this one person perform once a day for an entire year as a project? It's because maybe their sibling invented file sharing. So it's like, great, maybe, you know. But the thing is, it makes you feel inferior because you just don't have the time and money. People say, you know, everybody's got the same 24 hours that Beyonce does, but that's not true. She's got more time and effort, or took more time and resources and money. It's just not the same 24 hours.
Yeah. Plus you get nannies, someone handing her juice.
Right.
Like someone who's like, hey, get on that treadmill right now. Like, I don't have those people. I want those people, but they cost money. Right. You're right. You're right. Now, so we got to this discussion through this development of like when you started, when you got into big cities, the like changes that you viewed when you were there. How did that then? So if you saw this kind of stuff going on and it, you know, left a bad taste in your mouth, how did you develop your own like way in the world, right? You're not one of the trust fund kids. You don't think it's cool to be just lifting up just the people you like and not the people who need it, B, the people who want it, and C, the people who deserve it. Like, what part, how did you motivate yourself to, you know, start performing and teaching and getting involved in a place that you just didn't have a road for you?
So I started teaching when I was in college. So I started in 1999 teaching. When I got to New York, I was like,
right. So your improv career started in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Started in Pittsburgh. 1997.
Great.
Is when I started.
Better place to start. Great. Yes. Awesome.
I mean, I'd be happy to discuss that for a moment. So I love Pittsburgh improv.
Great
because
people.
Of what it gave to me. Like so there was a show, Friday Night Improvs. It ran for 25 years. It's maybe ASCAT edged it out at some point as being the longest running improv show in the world. I think it has now. It's 25 years. And just about anyone funny that came through Pittsburgh in that time, came through and was part of it. And for a long time, they were my students. Because after 2 years of performing improv, I realized nobody was teaching. And I didn't really want to teach, but I often feel like I need to do the things that nobody else wants to do that need to be done. And so I taught. You know, and like, you know, the director of the Eric Appel, who's directing the Weird Al Yankovic movie, he came through there. Christine Nangle, who's writing it on The Simpsons, she came through there. You know, there's a lot of people that really benefited from their time there. But Friday Night Improvs was a 2-hour weekly improv jam, a short form jam. It was every Friday night at 11 p.m. and it ran until 1 a.m. And it was great. We got through, you know, it was, there was no team. There was no troupe. It was a host and an audience. And the host would say, this is how you play this game. Who wants to come down and play it? And so I had the luxury of performing and sort of just figuring out improv in front of 150 people a week, who were all trained to be very supportive. And I found that to be really helpful, but the thing is nobody was teaching. So, you know, after a year of doing that, I got, somebody suggested reading Truth in Comedy and Impro. I read those books. And then just, through doing scene work at that show every week, I was teaching myself improv from the books. Like I was trying things out. I was doing what the book said. And then, yeah, I started teaching, and I love teaching. I've been doing it ever since. But I mean, in terms of how I made my own way in New York, I often don't fit very well in systems because I do call out irresponsible leadership. And my friend,
yeah, they don't from love high school, that. Yeah,
my friend from high school, like, and my younger sister does it too. I have a friend named Brady who I went to high school with, and I talked to him, you know, a couple months ago, and he's like, yeah, if a teacher ever did anything that was like unjust, I would just turn and see what you or your sister would do. Because we would call it out. We both believe in justice and in people being kind to other people. But that's how it is. And like, I think basically at some point I just, you know, I wanted to be a teacher at UCB, and I realized I kept getting so close to being put on a team so many times. I just couldn't get it put on a team. And the thing is, they only really wanted somebody that, was on a team to be teaching. 'Cause you know, Harold Knight is a demo for students. It is an enticement. It's the floor model, you know? And I asked the head of the school, like, I'd like to be a teacher. Is there any way for me to figure that out? And he said, well, make a name for yourself as a coach. Well, it just so happened I got horribly injured. Oh, I just snapped it. Like, I got horribly injured at Trader Joe's. I was working at Trader Joe's for 5 years while I was in New York. And I was out on medical leave for a while. And I decided to start coaching while I was doing that because I could coach. I just couldn't lift heavy objects. And like I said, in the beginning, I just felt like, well, nobody needs another coach in New York. Everybody has got this covered. Even though I'd done it for so long, I started doing it. And I ended up picking up, a pretty good reputation. I think I was coaching, teaching as many as 13 different groups a week for about 7 years.
Wow.
And I was just grinding and grinding and grinding. And the thing is, there's no other place in the world and no other time that I would have ever been able to do that. And I, as poor as I was and as like hard as that was and as many nights as that took up and maybe kept me from performing as much as I wanted to be, that was a once in a lifetime opportunity to do that because I was able to experiment and test things across so many different groups of people with so many different performers who are doing improv for vastly different reasons and in different ways, not just UCB students, but Magnet, Pit, Annoyance, Reckless, whatever improv theater out there. And then just my own classes and applied improv stuff. I got to really experiment and I developed my own methods that way. I'd already, you know, when I started teaching in New York when I started teaching in Pittsburgh, I didn't know how to teach. I'd never taken an improv class. I'd read some books, but I started like adapting Meisner exercises and just making things up and going like, let's try this. And I did that even more in New York. I started off trying to ape what everybody else was doing. 'Cause I was like, well, that's what people need. And then I started just going back to the methods that I'd been creating when I was like 19. And because it was useful. It was getting things out of people. I see in Facebook groups or on forums, when people talk about problems in their improv classes, they're not problems that I see. And that doesn't, I'm not saying I'm better than anyone else. I'm just saying there's something about the approach, my approach, that I'm like alleviating tensions before we see some of the symptoms that come out in other people's improv classes. Again, it's not a better than, I'm just doing it differently. So I'm always interested to hear what other people's perspectives are and what other people's experiences are. But I've had really great success. I just get people to drop their tension and just kind of relax and be themselves. I try to create a very safe space. I reward experimentation. You know, I had gone to graduate school for journalism before I moved back to New York. And in graduate school, we were taught to experiment. So I get back, I start retaking UCB classes, and I'm experimenting in the class. And the teacher's frustrated because the thing is, they're not necessarily a developed teacher. They're following a very strict lesson plan. We got to keep it going. You know, I was expecting that this was going to be a laboratory, and it really wasn't. It was a set of checklists that they had to get through, and it wasn't really working. It wasn't until I became registrar and I could actually see all the secret notes that were being kept on us that I could, that I knew what the reaction to that had been, which was like, when I just did what they wanted me to do, they were like really happy with that. And so I was able to adjust and do just what the teacher wanted me to do. I mean, it's not that different from what my experience was like in elementary and high school, honestly.
Sure. Also, goes right back to our power discussion earlier about the idea that, like, when somebody creates a school and they think right. that they have the right view of what right. to do, they create these syllabus, and then, like, that's it. Don't try to, like, deviate from it. I'm right. like, you know, anytime I teach at a place and they're like, this is what our guidelines are, but if you have a better way of communicating this lesson, right. go ahead. I'm like, yeah. that's good, because I've yeah. done a bunch of these different things. I know what yeah. works and what doesn't. And this one is great and all, but not going to yeah. work for me. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And I want to be like, and the thing is, I loved UCB. I had a blog sure. called UCB Love. I saw, for real, it's still up on Tumblr somewhere, I'm sure. I think what was happening was I saw the community as I'd taken class in 2004. I came back in 2009. And I'd seen the changes in the community. It just gotten too big. There were 7,000 students a year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea of community was like, diffused enough that people just didn't feel connected to it. So I was trying to find ways to like help people feel connected. I should also acknowledge that I've had codependent tendencies for a good chunk of my life. I think I've overcome those, but that does kind of feel like that a little bit. I do like to help other people. I think at one point it was, I like to take care of other people a little bit. It was just frustrating. Once I started working behind the scenes, I started understanding like, what was actually happening, how students were thought of. One of our students got hit by a train, and she was a diversity student. And I had talked my way into the creation of a diversity liaison position that didn't exist at the time. So I was always trying to speak up for these students and get their experiences and stuff. And I mentioned that the student had gotten hit by a train. And the head of the diversity program just made a joke about how maybe she should have taken the classes that her diversity scholarship had come with. And I was like, oh, okay, that's where I am. This person just, she didn't die. Louis C.K. paid her hospital bill. And she's still working. She's still doing great. But it was a weird... God, that was a weird reaction that one of our students got hit by a train. And that was the joke. It was like, come on, man, what are you doing? You're in a position of power. What is the deal? You're supposed to be a leader. Oh, it just frustrated me. And then, you know, like, and then just to deal with, like, talk to the students. I started realizing how different the experience was of students who didn't look like me, who maybe were older or were, you know, not white or whatever. Basically people that had experiences that set them apart from the standard, the UCB standard, basically. They were just getting a different experience. I had a student, I was working the front desk one time. A black student came out crying. I said, I said, "What's wrong? Are you okay?" And she said, basically she'd been in a class, and there was a substitute teacher, they were running some exercise where you work together to create the title of a movie and say what the plot is and say who the actors are, or whatever. And this student skipped a turn and didn't do what he was supposed to be doing in the exercise, just to point at her and label her as Whoopi Goldberg. Like, that alone was a funny joke. So she was thrown by that. She was kind of rattled by that, but she kept going. She kept doing the exercises. And in the next round, somebody mentioned a white British actor that she didn't know. She just didn't know who it was. And the teacher chided her for not knowing who this person was. And again, these are like, you know, microaggressions, but they add up. You know, a white person that's not experiencing that is going to be like, "Oh, that's just one thing," but they don't realize it's many one things. You know, it's just one thing after another. And we talked about it, and I said, "Look, these people are dumb, but I want you to have a good time." She said, "Look, I out in the world, I have to be a black woman. And that's how people see me. And in here, the reason I'm doing improv is I get to be anyone I want to be. And they keep reducing me to this thing." And I said, "Yeah, that's, I mean, I can't, you know, I couldn't relate. I mean, I'm not going to have the same experience." But I said, "Look, I want you to still get something out of that class. I think you can get something out. I think you can go back, hopefully, and still have a good class. Afterwards, if you want, come talk with me." And so afterwards, she and I sat for half an hour in my office and we talked. But it was just like, that was a big moment for me, was to get that experience. And then also, being the diversity liaison, I was asking for students' experiences. And this stuff was happening all the time. There was one student who, again, took that, the head of the diversity program took his class. She was a black actor, and she, there was, you know, 201. 201's the toughest class at Upright Students Brigade. And it's when people learn how to do Game of the Scene. And in the class, it was, the game that came up was "Mexican things make me sick." That was the game. Here's the thing. Sometimes in improv, two ideas get put together, and in combination, they are not good. Like, they just, they're a problem. Like, I know other people, yep, who, you'll get two people and one person will talk about the relationship. Like, the two people will blurt out two things. "We're in a relationship." And the other person's like, "Oh, this person's like an adult and I'm a child." These words will just come out at the same time. And you're like, "Oh shit." In synthesis, these ideas are uncomfortable and problematic, but you have to deal with them. And this student said, "This is racist. This idea is racist." And the entire class, including the teacher, turned on her. And so I kept encountering experiences like this, and I was really frustrated about it. It was just, it was really, and then the thing is, I couldn't stop acknowledging that. Like, I just needed people to, that's when I really started becoming outspoken, because like, there's a chance that someone might listen to me and not maybe give me as much shit for me to say some of the liberal stuff that I say. But like, other people had even more to lose, I felt like. I know that I became a pain in the ass. really, to the people that didn't like it. But God, it was so frustrating to find out that that's what people were dealing with all the time.
So how did it resolve for you? How did you move forward and do something different? I mean, you're clearly connected to many theaters through the coaching experience that you had. So you weren't necessarily tied to UCB, though. Again, I understand the swan song of UCB. I 100% understand it. I'm only now really truly understanding the breadth of the negativity that was there. I was still part of, people who look at it like it's the end all be all.
Right. But I mean, it was just, yeah, it was a, it for some people, it could be a real sausage grinder. You know,
sure.
It's just like, you know, it chewed a lot of people up, and there were a lot of toxic guys in there that were victimizing women. There was a lot of that stuff. I mean, it was really troubling. How did I go on from that? It was just, I did it despite them. Here's something I did. I realized that every class there'd be like a couple of empty seats because like somebody would always drop out last minute. I had the IT department create a system that would fire off every time my seat became open. And then I created something online that students could use to know when a class that they wanted suddenly opened up, or a teacher that they wanted their class suddenly opened up. And it made UCB thousands of dollars because suddenly those openings were filled. Also, in those emails they would get from this app would be my coaching details. So people knew who I was and they started coming to me. And so I was marketing myself in a way that other coaches weren't. I also was working I had just come out of retail, and if you've ever worked retail, you know that you're working constantly. And so your work ethic tends to be a little bit, you know, ratcheted up. And I just worked and worked and worked. And I just made sure that I was at the top of improvcoaches.com when people went to the site. And I just immediately emailed people back. I showed up on time, which was important. And like, I just was always there for my students. There were a lot of people, a lot of my students would be like, wow, you actually showed up on time. A lot of our coaches show up like 15 minutes late. I was like, no, this is important. We're going to treat this like this is important. And in the end, it was just like, I built a reputation for myself as a teacher. And sometimes it came by way of word of mouth, or somebody saw me perform and asked me to coach, but I just did it. And I knew people were annoyed also about that I was doing it without being on a house team, that I was doing what I was like coaching full time. It was insane how much I was able to do. But again, you know, that world doesn't exist anymore. That allowed me to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you working at UCB until the crumble, like I was with the new movement?
Experience, but basically one day a friend of mine said, hey Chris, we're gonna be working together. I worked on the weekends as registrar in addition to being the diversity liaison. I want to be clear, Keisha Zoller, who had put together that diversity program, never got paid. Now I was getting paid to be registrar, but I was taking on extra duties for the diversity program, but not getting paid for that. I just felt it needed to be done. So UCB just did not pay for diversity. And people can say, oh, well, they gave all these free classes away. It's like, no. Classes are not money. Free seats and classes, that's just free. You know, you're always going to have extra stuff. I feel like I've gotten off my train of thought because I really wanted to say this. What was your question again?
It's okay. Say what you wanted to say and then I'll bring us back.
Yeah, so I don't know.
It's okay. I had asked you if you had worked for UCB until the crumble.
Right, okay.
And you said no, you found a way out.
Right. No, this is what happened. So a friend of mine says, we're going to be working together. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I'm going to be working these hours. And I was like, nope, those are my hours. I think you've been hired to replace me. Now, nothing negative had ever been said to me about my work. Not a single negative thing had been said to me about my work. I occasionally would come in, they'd leave their, there was one time I came in, somebody's email was left open, and it was an email about me, which was like, one thing I was doing was, in the winter, every morning when it had snowed, students would write in, our class is canceled. Well, the thing is, classes started at 9, and that's also when the employees came in. So who was going to answer those students' questions? Even though I worked the weekends, I just log in to see if anybody had emailed that and asked, and I would say, classes aren't canceled unless the MTA is closed, unless the subway is shut down. And they'd be like, Does Chris think he's going to get overtime? Does Chris think he's going to get more money? I never asked for that. It was something that needed to be done. So it was just weird. It was just weird to be talked about. But like that was the only, it was just that I was doing more work than I was being asked to do. But the thing is, this isn't an unusual situation. This happened a lot. People get replaced by other people without even knowing that there'd ever been an issue with their work. You know, there's one woman that worked for Torco, and she asked them about if there was a similar position at Torco in Los Angeles. Because if there was, she would be interested in transferring and moving to LA and having that job. And a month later, she found out that she had been replaced because they didn't actually listen to her. They thought she was trying to quit, I guess. And so she lost her job. That sort of stuff happened all the time. It was insane. The way that company was run was crazy. They didn't pay their people, but they sure got very lush offices and, you know, the training incentive they had in this very nice office building. And that's where the money went. But like, they had volunteers for everything. It was just insane. I didn't expect to shit on UCB this entire time, honestly.
No, you don't have to. Yeah. No, it's not about that. For me, I'm just trying to move us forward in your journey. Like,
yeah,
you had this experience. Right. It was rough. How did you, did you move away from New York? And that's how you, after they ousted you. And I want to stay focused on you because I was I know. I could tell you how I got ousted. No. Wait. Let's stick with you. Your thing.
This stuff happens all the time.
It's important to know.
Yeah, I know, but it's so hard being. I hate being negative, even when I'm saying is like true. You know what I mean? It's really tough.
Earlier we were talking about some negative stuff and you said that it is important to be said out loud because people won't feel like it's okay to talk about it if we don't. So you're right. And you're right. This was a shitty thing that happened. That theater is not even in existence anymore. They have some people in LA doing stuff, but LA is already built on gold in a weird way. I feel like that was, we all got that blonde people were better in California. But in New York, you thought, oh, there's diversity here. Maybe there will be some in the theaters, and it wasn't.
So the annoyance comes to New York. They scout me to be a teacher and they tell me, oh, great. Hey, if you just take these classes, you'll be a teacher. And I was like, okay, cool. That would be great. I'll take these classes. I don't really have the money for it, but I'm going to try and do it. But the first thing I told them was like, you should focus on diversity. No one else in the city is focused on diversity. It would be a niche for you. And you'd actually probably do pretty well if you just made that a focus. And they didn't. And for many reasons, then that theater just fell apart. And it was like, it was just so, it was weird. That was a weird, situation too. They came and they went. It was just really just me scrabbling from one thing to the next. I ended up teaching my own classes. I think that ended up just being that was my way out, was I created Thunderbolt Comedy. I taught my own classes. I put up my own shows. And that was my big success. You know, it's funny, going back to Pittsburgh, I was so frustrated that I had to teach the performers that I wanted to perform with. But that's the frustration. I was like, well, when I go, you know, if I go to New York, there'll be other trained performers I can perform with them. But in the end, I've come up with a much simpler method to get the kind of results people want. And I've enjoyed teaching it. I don't know. It's such a balance. Like the teaching can take over, and to some extent it has. I love teaching. Now I've come to San Francisco. I think in the end, I felt like I could feel things changing in New York. I could feel, what had been called the second comedy boom. Was ending. I owned that domain for a while, secondcomedyboom.com. It forwarded to Thunderbolt Comedy. And so I just like, I sold some things and then just dumped the rest of my stuff. And I packed up and moved in with two bags to San Francisco the way I had to New York with nothing. And I started teaching classes and that kept me going. And the thing is, that was such an investment. That was such a risk and it was such a sacrifice to do all of that. It was a calculated risk. It was a calculated gamble. And as it was paying off and I was selling, I sold out shows. I had great classes here. And then a pandemic happened. So I moved back home with my parents for a year and a half. Yeah. So that was easy. That was so easy. It wasn't difficult at all. It wasn't like reliving my childhood and the sort of weird emotional abuse of that. Instead, it was all of those things. It was very difficult. And so, yeah, then it was like, well, what do I want to do? You know, I had to finish out a class that I'd started in San Francisco on Zoom, and I hated it. I hated it. I can't stand doing improv on Zoom. I don't like watching improv on Zoom. It's not built for this. So one of my students, Michael Parlato, and I started talking, and we built an alternative called Pineapple, which I still love. It's still up. We just haven't updated it in forever. But it's like built for improv. It's built for live improv. It looks like a couple Polaroids laid out with people's video in the Polaroid, and you can switch them. You can swap where you are on screen effortlessly. There's a stage. There's a like a sideline or back, you know, kind of a, at the bottom, there's like a tray that's like the back line. And you know, you could tag somebody and swap places with them instantly. You know, really you could swap out the background behind all of the Polaroids. So we weren't dealing with green screen. So there wasn't as big of a like investment in some of that stuff. And it was just simpler and it was faster and it was lighter and it didn't take us as much data and like, system resources as Zoom. But I mean, like, who knows? It was a big experiment, you know? And so we did that for, yeah. And we did it. And I'm so proud of it. We had 1,000 registered users in 4 months. And that was great. It's just that, you know, everybody had learned Zoom and that had been such a difficult process. Nobody wanted to learn a new platform. I wouldn't say nobody. People were using it. There were shows produced in it. People ran classes in it. I starred in a Kansas City, Missouri fringe play. It wasn't the fringe. It was like a queer play festival. And I met with the producers and then they're like, do you also want to audition? And then I got cast as the lead in this. And then I was also teching Pineapple while I was acting. And we were able to do that. It was great.
That's too much work at once. No acting and teching at the same time. Just, no.
Yeah. It was so much fun. I mean, and I'm glad that it existed. And even though like, it's not like the success maybe we would have hoped. I'm glad we did that. And I was really,
you know what? Keep it open and keep it, you know, you'll find an audience for it. I remember I was at a podcast festival in March 2020 when the world started to crumble. Right. And it was like we went to the festival and people were already like elbow bumping, but wasn't quite masked yet, right? So everybody there was like, Zoom, 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 Zoom's the thing. Right. And I was like, ugh, Zoom. I don't want to do Zoom. Why? I don't want to do it. I was very reticent. I was not interested. I was like, listen, I got Skype. I'm done. Like, I don't need this. Like, why do I need something I already have? But all of a sudden, somebody was like, it just happened. Yeah. You like can't. Get away from the rising tide. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's coming for you. It's knocking you over. Nothing to be done. Yeah. Now, that being said, you're right that there was some fatigue for, like, new stuff. Yeah. But what you're talking about sounds really cool. And, like, legitimately, like, not that I'm going to, like, try to give you a new business plan, but I kind of am. the one thing that I've been working on recently is getting into schools. Like, I was helping people do like Zoom shows in schools because I was good. I learned how to technically run a Zoom thing. And so people that were presenting classes to students over Zoom needed like a tech. And so I was doing that. Yeah. And so just throwing out there, your app could be an awesome thing for like, you know, schools, various things, even just, you know, because this happens a lot in my comedy club stuff. I teach a comedy camp for kids, and there's this handful of homeschool kids who like don't interact except for during comedy camp. And they're always really fun. And it wouldn't it be fun if they had like a theater class on your app, right? Because like they're so unique and creative and interesting that like all the features you just described are like, I'm like, oh, that sounds like a super fun like mixtape that like is in real life.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of is, you know, our focus with Pineapple was to, you know, and I can't speak highly enough of what, like I said, my partner in Pineapple, Michael Parlato, he just did really amazing work. So anything the two of us came up with, he could make. And then also every time I'd talk to him, he'd surprise me with, hey, look at this feature I added. Like, I didn't know about this background idea, because you could just drop a JPEG in a form, and then suddenly the little field on the page, and click submit or whatever, and then it would just be up behind everybody. And he just surprised me with that one day. But I mean, like, we made it so that, because Zoom is still sort of top down, the person who is hosting is in control. But that's not how I think. So Pineapple, everybody's in control. Everybody can edit anytime. Everybody has the power. And so, but then what we started to realize was we needed to pivot toward classes, because shows don't make money. The money is going, you know, the money is in classes, and we need the money to keep the project going. And so we had to start figuring out ways to actually put restrictions on some things, so that if you had a teacher who needed to be in control of a class, they could actually be in control of the class. They could actually turn off people's ability to, you know, to swap places with each other and things like that. So you could actually be heard. I think, honestly, I don't think it's completely dead. I could see it come back at some point. It's still there, like I said. I think one of the things that was difficult was that it was built on Chrome. And so when Chrome would update, the site would have some issues suddenly, because we had to then update it to match Chrome. But that's the case with most web apps anyways. Most of them only work in Chrome. And then when Chrome updates, it's a real issue. But the thing is, we hadn't been around for 9 years like Zoom and have hundreds of people working on it, you know? So it was just two of us. And it was funny, because like we put so much time and effort and money into it, and then we get like improvisers that would try it, and they'd be like, this is great, but it's not like Zoom in these ways, or you should. And it was like really tough, because it was like, we're just really working hard on this thing, and we get some like snide improvisers that were telling us that we should do what this giant corporation is doing. It was such a funny thing, but it was, you know, it was such a good experience. And like I said, Michael worked so hard on that. And I just saw him the other night, and it was good to see him, because he's here in San Francisco. I moved back. I got a sales job in San Francisco, so I've moved back, and I've been here for the past 7 months.
Oh, great. So like, you finished your time at home with the parents, the pandemic moment, which we all get, like 100%. And then you were able to get back out on your own in San Fran. Good. That's great. Yeah. That's good.
Well, it's funny, because, you know, part of my intention in coming to San Francisco was I in the first place, and this is pre-pandemic, I thought, if there's an economic downturn, the people in San Francisco will still have enough money to pay me to teach them improv. Because there's people have money. I just didn't know that a pandemic could be possible, because that really kind of disrupted whether that possibility. But my idea was that, and then I also wanted to try to parlay my improv teaching into some sort of soft skills type role at a tech company. And the thing is, it did happen. While I was home with my parents, someone that I used to coach got a job at the company that I'm at now, and she referred me, and I did end up getting the job. It's weird, like the risks that I took have been paying off somehow, and it's really nice to see.
Wow. So like the job you work now in San Francisco has, you know, some smattering of improv teaching in it to help you or to help them rather.
Oh, no. Well, so I'm just working in sales, and I am teaching people on my team things that I'm doing. I'm doing things, you know, when I first came into it, they were doing, you know, phone sales and stuff like that. But I keep going like, what if we tried this? So I've been making sales off of like Facebook. I just talk to people and then I get a sale. I work for a company where it's a completely free service. You just need to show people how great it is and then they'll bite. And so I was just like, well, why are we only calling? And then I had taught sales at Yelp and some other places. And so I've been teaching some of that stuff because it's all the same, you know, like if you're in a job interview, if you're in sales, if there's something you want, you just have to match the other person. You match their behavior, you match their demeanor, their, you know, all that stuff. That's what I did in my interview for this job. Every time I had an interview, I matched the posture and the tone of the person that was interviewing me. One time I had one of the interviews was I had to be interviewed by 5 people in a row. And so I matched everybody every time I talked to them, but also whatever the previous person had told me, I would tell them. So they'd be like, I feel like this is a way that I'm thinking about the company. I'm like, oh, that's cool. The next person, I'm like, oh, it kind of seems like the company's like this. And I just kept repeating back to them the things everybody else had said. And it worked. I got the job.
Oh, my God. I love it. I love it. These are like improv games like, oh, my God, just mirroring wins.
I mean, that's all it is. Like, it's all, I mean, honestly, this is what we know this. It's all improv. Personalities are performed. You know, it's all just improv. And so, you know, like, you know, I also, you know, I had a company called Engage for a while, too, with my friend Tarek. I love that. Like, Tarek's semi-famous now, so I'm like, do I say his last name? But Tarek Davis, he's great. He and I taught Applied. He's on the Amber Ruffin show. He was on Broadway with Freestyle Love Supreme. He's like one of the most talented human beings I've ever met. But after the 2016 election, he came to me and he said, like, we should work on some sort of applied improv project to try to help people reconnect, because there was such a, you know, it's only gotten worse, but you know, there's such a rift between people, and we ended up developing a really great class where we were teaching people how to reach out to estranged loved ones. And that was really good. That was a really great thing. But yeah, basically we ended up both, you know, having other things to work on, and that kind of went by the wayside, but that was such a great experience working with Tarek and stuff.
What do you think, all these things that you've told me about, these different kinds of products and the work that you do, what is it that drives you? You mentioned earlier that you believe in justice and people being kind to each other, but like, is that your driving force? Is that what keeps you coming up with these ideas?
I realized when I was in college how much I care about truth. You know, I was studying journalism, I did comedy. You know, there were a couple other things where I'm like, oh, I guess the defining idea is truth. I love the idea of truth. But then another thing is, I want to put tools in people's hands. And sometimes, And also just like unlock people. That's the way I feel about what I'm doing. I'm teaching is I'm not giving people new things. I'm just unlocking the abilities and skills that were already there. And you know what? I want to be clear. I'm not doing it. I'm helping them do it. They're the ones that are doing it. I want to be clear about that. I'm not doing this for them. They're doing it. I'm coaching them. I'm getting them where they want to go. or I'm showing them places they may want to go, but like they're in the end, they're the only ones that can really do it. Like there's only so far you, there's only so far you can get someone as a teacher. They have to come with you. And I want to make sure that, that I'm not taking responsibility for the work that they are doing. We're getting there together. Those are the things that I really care about, as I want people to, I don't know, it might be my love of superheroes. Like my Thunderbolt comedy logo looks like a superhero symbol for a reason. I like the idea that inside everybody is these unlocked talents and abilities, and they can be a superhero. They can see the things that make them weird and realize that those are actually the things that make them great. And those are their superpowers. So, yeah,
I totally agree. I have that exact same vibe when it comes to my improv teaching as well. I'm like, I just want you to know, like, every one of you are bringing something to the table that's important, and we just need to figure out, you just need to acknowledge what that is.
Yeah.
Like,
the joy I have in teaching is unmatched, I think, by most things in my life. I feel that I am my truest self when I'm performing on stage. And I feel like I'm my truest self when I'm teaching. I am vulnerable. I get in there with the performers. Like I'm with them every step of the way. I just want to be available. And yeah, I want to make myself available as a resource to other people. Yeah. Again, is that codependent? I don't know. You know, I think
you'll have to ask your therapist. Right. I'm not the one who can be helpful there.
Right. Right.
I know that it seems that way since we've been talking for so long, and I'm drawing your personal thoughts out of you. But,
but I mean, it's, you know, I like to check in with myself, you know, and just go.
Yeah. Like, am I codependent now?
Right. Yeah. So I don't know. It's just like, I don't believe in the concept of laziness. I don't believe in people being bad or wrong or evil. I believe that there are some like horrible things, certainly, that people do. But I think that there is an inherent value and goodness in everybody. And I just want to help people bring that out of themselves, even though they might have like stuffed it away. Mm. So.
Yeah, that's nice. One last question, and then I will release you to the night. What is the way in which you are filling up your own creative cup? You're doing so well to help other people,
right. But
what are you doing for you?
I am at a place where that is not happening. At this current moment, I am in... So what I teach people is... I've got a class now called 100% Certain. I get people I'm encouraging people to be their most confident selves in class. It's all about just like, it's about no maybes, no I thinks. It's just being confident, making the move, and then committing to it. That's my focus. Right now the world is in an in-between place. We're like the space between panels in a comic book. That's where we are right now. Your previous guest, Rhiannon Jenkins, is now my fiance. And she's in England, and we are waiting on a visa for her to come here and marry me. And, you know, I feel like everything is, look, everything in the world is always temporary, but right now it's just waiting for something to happen. And so I feel like I'm in between places, but it is time. It is time to open up and like, let my pandemic armor down. And be creative again. And so I'm talking to people about what my next show is. I'm not sure. I kind of want to do a show about shame and have people, have audience members share their shame. Mm-hmm.
Something gentle, fun. Yeah, I get it.
It's San Francisco. Here's the thing about San Francisco. In New York City, people don't talk about where they're from because they want to be New Yorkers. In San Francisco, everybody has, I don't say everybody, many, many people have escaped things to come to San Francisco, and they will talk about it more. They'll talk about where they're from. But I feel like there is quite a selection of fugitives and refugees in San Francisco. And I think that, you know, I'm always trying to, build a show around the experience I want an audience to have. And all I want to do is release. I like to build tension and then release it. And that's why I want to aim at something like that. It's just like, let's make everybody feel something and then let's release it.
Yeah, I love it. Now, when I asked the creative question, yeah. It wasn't about what shows you're producing, because believe you me, I understand
I'm gonna be
the
in
output, the right, output right. of shows
right.
Is hard to do. I mean, like I said, I have a 4-year-old, so like
I am
not really producing as many shows as I used to. But I mean, like, do you read books? Do you like watch movies? What's the thing that you like that's your other people's creative stuff that you're soaking up? What's the way that you do it? Do you read, you know, writing prompts on Reddit? Like, what are your things?
I mean, I read too much internet, and then I watch so many YouTube videos, and then like I'm obsessed right now. This just feels like on the nose right now. I've gotten sucked into this YouTube series called Audit the Audit. That's all about like looking at police stops and how well they were handled by the police and the person that was worked. And what it does is it just I get so angry. I get so angry. And then I don't know why that's what I'm watching right now. I don't enjoy being angry all the time, but I think like a recreational anger can be fun. I get so mad. Anyways, but like I watch, I'm really into the Marvel movies. One thing I've always liked about comic books, like a shared universe, is that you get these pieces, and then as a reader, you get the sense of like connecting all those things together. And that relates in some ways to the teaching that I do, because I have sort of a pointillist approach where it's like, make a couple specific choices and we create an environment where the audience can project into the space between those choices. That's what I'm looking like. So I love that. I love that experience. It's why I like comic books. It's the combination of art and literature together, as said by Scott McCloud in Understanding Comics. This idea of like connecting things together in your own brain. That's the stuff that I really love. I love like, what can I project into and experience something. But yeah, I think those are the main things. And I always like science fiction, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. Since a tiny child, you and your sci-fi. Yeah,
That's right. You brought it back.
There you go. Yeah. Oh my God. Well, Chris, listen, this has been a wild conversation from pre-record to now. We have just really talked about the breadth of things. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
I do feel like the pre-recording conversation kind of set a tone for the rest of the conversation. So it was really,
you know, maybe a little. We had a harsh beginning for sure, but it's okay. I mean, I feel like we had a good convo, both about your journey and then the rough ups and downs that you know, you interacted with. We can't remove those from our life, so might as well reflect upon them. And with me, you're safe. And to be honest, with the audience that's listening, it's all improvisers. It's all people that do theater stuff. Like, it's, you know, it's a crowd that will benefit from the knowledge, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
We'll take care of each other. That's all I ask.
Yes, absolutely. Wherever you are in the world, if your community is as toxic as the ones that Chris and I have encountered, take care of each other. And if it isn't, celebrate how great your community is.
Because
turns out it could be so much worse. Oh, man. But listen, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. You've brought so much to it. Great conversation. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Sorry, you just made me giggle with your little, like, I appreciate it. Like, okay, thanks.
Thank you for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all of our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.